The first reading this morning consists of two passages from the novel Dr. Zhivago, considered by many to be the greatest single international novel of the 20th century. The author, Boris Pasternak, was pressured by the Soviet government to refuse the Nobel Prize for Literature, which he was granted, but his son was eventually able to accept the honor after the fall of the Soviet Union. The novel has been filmed 3 times. The famous United States version by David Lean, a British broadcasting company televised version, and a Russian made-for-TV movie about 10 years ago. The photo of the candle flame melting solidified ice crystals on the window, which is on the cover of your orders, is an image from the David Lean version, and it illustrates the following 2 passages. I assure you, you do not have to have seen the movies nor to have read the novel for the images in these 2 sections to make sense to you. First, Lara liked to sit in the light of candles in the evening, foregoing electric lights. So Pasha, her fiancé, always kept a few candles around. He replaced the burned-out stump in the candlestick sitting on the windowsill, and he lit it. The flame choked and sputtered at first, shooting off small sparks like stars, and then finally settled into the smooth shape of an arrow. Soft light filled the room. In the sheet of ice covering the windowpane, a small, clear place appeared, like the iris of the eye, right at the level of the flame. Second part. As they were driving through Kamager Street in their sleigh, Yura noticed that a candle had melted a patch in the icy crust on one of the windows. The light seemed to look into the street almost consciously, as if it were watching the passing carriages and waiting for someone. The second reading comes from a book by the much revered Joan Chittister, one of the great social thinkers of our time, a thinker who writes from within her Roman Catholic tradition, always expressing herself with a universalist slant. She lives up in Erie, Pennsylvania, not very far from here.
Powerlessness is not a virtue. We seriously think we have rights and power and place, but in this world of mega corporations, global networks, and invisible international links, the individual has never been so assertive and never so powerless. Life, for the most part, is beyond our control. We boast about democratic participation and watch votes discarded at the whim of a few. We glory in the impregnability of our national defense and watch the economic center of our country go down in minutes under the blow of 2 commercial airlines, our own, while standing helplessly by. But we must put down the temptation to powerlessness. It is a matter of refusing to allow what ought to be changed to conform us to itself. It is a matter of refusing to allow what ought to be changed to conform us to itself. That alone would be an act of hope to many, and a spark of hope in my own soul. It would tell me I am still alive, that my soul has not died at the hands of the culture around me. Look, the only difference between hope and despair I see is that despair shapes an attitude of mind, whereas hope creates a quality of soul. Here is what despair looks like. The Irish love to tell the story of Paddy McGarrity, who spent his life bemoaning all the circumstances of his life. Nothing satisfied him. But one gracious summer day, the sun burst through the fog and rain and spread over the Irish hills in a blaze of glory. "Ho, Paddy," the priest called to him over the fence. "Isn't it beautiful?" "Ah, sure, Father," Paddy moaned. "But will it last?" Hope, on the other hand, takes life on its own terms and expects that, whatever twists and turns, it will ultimately yield good to those who live it consciously, to those who live it to the hilt.
Well, no, the glorious sunlight over the Irish hills will not last, to answer the priest in the reading from Joan Chittister. But that is not the sad thing. The sad thing, I think, is expecting that anything will last forever. Especially this morning, I want to point out, especially the hard stories, the difficult events, the shocking news, the underbelly of human so-called civilization. Paddy McGarrity lived on the assumption of the permanence of misery. He was living in despair, that is, not hope. Now, I confess freely that despair is something I myself have felt any number of times. I have given up. I have made no room for hope in my heart. I allowed myself to rephrase Chittister in that quote that Mary read twice, to conform my attitude to what I could not personally change. As most of you know, I grew up in Detroit. Several other people in the congregation also grew up in Detroit. And we talk about that. Detroiters all hang together. When I was a kid, there was still evidence in my life as to why Detroit was called Detroit the Beautiful throughout the 30s in the last century. Streetcars glided down all of the main streets, several of the minor streets, It was a huge system. Architects came from other cities to study our building designs because they were so beautiful. And so great an artist as Diego Rivera came and painted a true fresco, wet plaster fresco, in the art museum there, which is every bit as grand and big and powerful and beautiful as the one Michelangelo Buonarroti painted in the Sistine Chapel, only on secular, not sacred themes. But as you know, if you read the newspaper or watch TV or just talk to other Detroiters who are living here now, Detroit lost it all in the last 30 years. It went bankrupt, an almost impossible thing for a city that size. Its downtown was abandoned almost completely. No stores left. Its buildings are collapsing. Its industry all replaced with robot workers and overseas plants. The streetcars were ripped up. Schools were closed. Libraries and churches were abandoned downtown. Thousands of hectares of downtown land returned to the state that once existed at the time of the Potawatomi, or as they call themselves, the keepers of the flame, Bodewatmi in their language, the original natives of that land. When, over the last 17 years, I would drive the 4 hours up to Detroit to visit family or friends, I would often weep while I drove through the barren, overgrown streets, the curbs crumbling under the weeds. My city had died. I despaired of it ever rising again. If you have time after the service, and I hope that you'll take a little time, please come forward and look at this giant photo book up here at the edge of the chancel. Detroit Disassembled is the name of the book. The photographs in this book were originally taken about 6-7 years ago, and they were about the size of the center part of this wall, and they were the kind of photography where even if you get up close, you can't see any dots. Purely clear reality. You'll get a sense if you look at this as to why I lived in despair about my home city, and whole sections of it are still not recovered yet. The Latin motto of the city during all these years has not changed. Resurgit Ceneribus. It shall rise out of the ashes. The Latin phrase refers to a fire that totally gutted the colonial city 2 centuries earlier. But it's still the motto. Lo and behold, my despair proved to be nothing but cheap arrogance on my part. Namely, if I couldn't fix it, if I couldn't see how anyone could restore it, then nobody could do it. But Detroit has indeed been rising up out of the ashes while I was giving up and indulging in cheap despair. Time magazine did a story last week about how the downtown skyscrapers are filling again, little by little, being restored. The bankruptcy is over and done with as of this week. Artists are moving in droves. Companies are establishing their world headquarters there, downtown. New buildings are going up. Old buildings, many of them really wondrously beautiful, are being restored tenderly. Where the land still is bare, the houses all burned down, urban farming and entrepreneurs are establishing fresh new communities. The auto companies themselves, throughout their hardship, have nevertheless protected the incredible art collection in the museum there, the best in the Midwest, which many wanted to actually sell off in order to save the city. I used to tell people in this church, just let them try it. I will be up there in a minute, chained to the door. The tiny flames of hope of 10,000 people pulling together for Detroit have melted the ice of my despair and taught me a pretty good lesson about hope. Oh, I know this is a complex issue because hope always seems to refuse to be clean and neat. One of the main financial supporters of the New Detroit is the CEO of Quicken Loans, a large mortgage corporation. If you get online, you will find out that there are many, many complaints about the company and severe accusations of fraud and hard sells. I don't know the whole story personally, but I'm certainly aware of all the sticky issues. And the young entrepreneurs I've been talking about are mostly white suburbans. The African American population, which is the majority population in Detroit, is hardly represented in this new boom. Ah, yes. It is complex, isn't it? Of course, that's most always true, I think. The early rabbis, back when they were trying to figure out this popular culture of celebrating Hanukkah, which came from the people 2,000 years ago, were caught up in the same sticky situation. Here was a story about war and death and mayhem, and the story of the rededication, Hebrew is Hanukkah, rededication of a building vandalized during that war. And then there was that strange story of the miraculous oil. A small cruise of oil was able to provide enough fuel for 8 oil lamps, predecessors to our waxy candles, to burn for over an entire week, the time it took to actually press new oil. The rabbis clearly understood that the idea of lighting little flames in oil lamps in a menorah was simply a delightful thing. They even understood that the violent war could be interpreted as a strong statement that nobody has the right to force others into a culture not their own. Absolutely, that's true. Still, the story involved the hardships of death and war, and so the rabbis were really uncomfortable about it. So they refused to call it a holiday, like Shavuos or Pesach or Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah. They referred to it instead as a minor observance. They encouraged the people to light their lights, not to glorify the violence. Sadly, this minor observance, under the influence of the juggernaut of Christmas commercialism here in the United States, is now, for many, something of a Jewish version of Christmas, complete with Hanukkah trees and lots of commercialism. And of course, the ancient war is over, but wars are still with us right now. There has been talk in the United States Congress this week of declaring official war against ISIL, the ISIL fanatics. And although the Afghanistan war, the longest in United States history, also officially ended this week, thousands of troops will still stay there indefinitely. The reading you heard from Dr. Zhivago this morning, Dr. Zhivago, my favorite novel, of which this is the first edition in Russian. If you have your silk gloves on, you can come and touch it later. It's also set during a time of upheaval and war, the First World War, and the Russian Revolution and the Russian Civil War. The man who wrote the novel, Boris Pasternak, lived throughout that era, his life, and he was writing his fiction, his novel, based upon the true observances of his own life and the upwelling of the anguish of his life in his heart. Pasternak had grown up in more peaceful times, immersed in the best culture of that era. His father was a famous post-impressionist painter, Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet I quoted at the top of the page of the Orders of Celebration, and considered by many to be the greatest German poet of all time, not Schiller, and the composer Alexander Scriabin, whose work you just heard before I began my words, were constant guests at his family home. He knew them and he loved them dearly, both of them, and also Leo Tolstoy, who was a good friend of his parents, and whose religious tendencies, pacifist religious tendencies, they followed, even though theirs was a Jewish home, one where they kept the festivals, including the minor observance of Hanukkah. But they really did gravitate throughout their lives toward Tolstoy's pacifist worldview. But all of that fell apart during the Revolution. The Revolution brought dislocation for almost everybody, bloodshed, and a total disruption of normal life, which Pasternak amply displays in his novel, Dr. Zhivago. Zhivago, by the way, is not a Russian name. It's not a Russian word. It's actually a word from Old Slavonic, which is the liturgical language used in the Russian Orthodox Church. And it means the one who is alive, the one who lives. But his novel is considered by all of his critics to be one of the great novels of hope ever written, no less than the children's story this morning, which was also set at wartime, which is also a story about hope. He invokes in his novel the love of individuals for each other, one-on-one, in contrast to the vast sweep of destructive history. Pasternak uses the image of a candle in the window to establish that interconnection of individual persons who, yes, support social equity, but who nevertheless refuse to partake in the violence that would establish the fair way of life, according to the leaders of the revolution. The candle burns in the window, warming and melting the ice, he says. Pasternak does not know his future lover, Lara, is up in the window that he notices as he drives by in the sleigh. Lara does not know that Yura Zhivago, her future lover, is riding in the sleigh down below, sitting next to his fiancée, Tanya. Candlelight in the window. Throughout his novel, Pasternak returns to this motif, so much so that all three of the cinematic versions of this novel make these particular images central in their filming. Over and over again, a candle in the window, individual lives, kindling lights, connected to people they don't know yet connected to them for real. Pasternak establishes that hope lies in this. Not some grandiose expectation that everything is going to magically turn out all right for everybody, because it must, it needs to. But it's something far more humble. He is saying that the violent, disappointing, and often shocking world we live in is still filled with folks who have not allowed themselves to be distorted into knots of despair, but who imagine that living life consciously and to the hilt, to quote Sister Chichester, in itself creates a tiny flame of hope which others will notice and move toward, offering their own lights in return, just like the boys in the story this morning. Hope is not grandiose. It's not everywhere. It's just local. A hope hotspot, to quote Oma Willett, who talked to me about hope last week. It is not bright sunshine dispersing the fog over the Irish hills. It is not feel-good optimism or some happy-go-lucky kick in your step. Hope is always small, homely, simple, and achievable by you, by me. Because it doesn't exist all by itself. It depends entirely on our personal interconnections. It depends on real community. It depends on not imagining yourself to be alone. You are not. It's an illusion. And knowing in your heart that many others see what you see and are willing to work with you at moving toward that vision step by step. Not necessarily at the dramatic barricades waving flags, but in a day-to-day action of connection, conversation, and care. Or simply walking step by step, by cold step, in Washington, D.C., or down at the State House on some Wednesday afternoon. I foolishly lost hope because I could not restore Detroit by myself, nor imagine how anybody else could possibly do it because it was so trashed. And now it's being restored despite my despair, my giving up. So I have retreated from the ease and self-congratulation of my despair and am recognizing little by little that with others over time, dead cities can rise. Candles without sufficient oil, according to the books, will still continue to burn. And the bloodshed of constant war will one day finally be forgotten. Long after we're gone, to be sure. But hopefully, partially because of us and our day-to-day kindling of a candle of hope, which others can see shining bright through the clear window of our lives, even if they don't know us yet.